Liberation Literacy is a racial justice reading group at Columbia River Correctional Institution in Portland.
We are students of revolutionary politics that have long been forgotten. The Harriet Tubmans, the Nat Turners, the Angela Davises, and the Malcolm X's, who recognized the systemic injustice in our country and saw themselves as active agents in fighting for change.
We meet weekly to discuss and reimagine the relationship between incarceration, our community, and ourselves.
Tune in to Prison Pipeline on July 10th to hear our discussion with National Book Award winner, historian Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, about his book, Stamped from the Beginning.
That's Prison Pipeline, July 10th at 6:30 p.m.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being a part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Here is an opportunity for you to join the KBOO Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all of our members. Please consider applying to become a KBOO Board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm or stop by the station to pick up paper copy. The deadline to apply is July 9th, 2017. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to our community, and want to carry forward KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, we'll screen the film tomorrow on Thursday, July 13th at 7 p.m. The documentary Tomorrow sets out to showcase alternative and creative ways of viewing agriculture, economics, energy, and education. It offers constructive solutions to act on a local level to make a difference on a global level. Instead of showing all the worst that can happen, this documentary focuses on the people suggesting solutions and their actions. Again, that's a film screening of the documentary Tomorrow, Thursday, July 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
Good morning. You are listening to Positively Revolting Talk Radio on KBOO in Portland. I'm Lynn, and I am very fortunate this morning to have the brilliant Linda Olson Osterlund as my co-host as Ani's at Fair this weekend.
That sounds so exciting. This is Linda. I haven't been to the country fair in probably 30 years. There I do age myself. But I always think of it with a little bit of longing.
It's just a lot of hot walking around to me, but that's
and
just
dust.
Me and dust, and lots of dust. Anyway, we are here this morning to talk about a pretty serious topic, and with us to talk about that is Christine Hong. She is associate professor at the USC at Santa Cruz. She's also on the executive board of the Korea Policy Institute. Some of the other places you can find her work is at the Critical Ethics Studies Association, the National Campaign to End the Korean War. You see where we're going here. Working Group for Peace and Demilitarization in Asia and the Pacific. What a great idea. And Legacies of the Korean War. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being with us today. This is quite the hot topic these days.
It is, yes.
It sort of has been. One of the things I just wanted to do, because of the sort of lack of historical knowledge these days, is get back to why the conflict in Korea started in the first place.
Well, I mean, I think that that's a really great point. You know, the fact of the matter is that everything that we're witnessing today has as its subtext the unfinished Korean War. And in fact, like when you see, you know, Donald Trump saying that, you know, what was his pronouncement with regard to the North Korea's ICBM launch? He said something like, he has, you know, severe things in mind for North Korea. And Nikki Haley went to the UN stating that there needs to be a military option, which
right.
basically
there's a new sheriff in town.
Option. Yes, and then like and Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, basically stated that he tried to strike a sort of more restrained sort of note, but still stated that the United States has all options on the table. And by contrast, the South Korean president, who is just elected, and he is a liberal, and we'll see, you know, I have cautious optimism with regard to him. He just had a summit with Trump. He stated over in Germany, he's also attending the G20. He stated that in a country that has historically known division in the wake of World War II Germany, as did Korea, even though Korea was not a fascist perpetrator of war violence during World War II, that was Japan, and Korea was a colony of Japan. Still, it knew the history of division. It was U.S.-authored division. What this president stated over there was that there needs to be a peace treaty and war cannot happen again. So as a subtext of everything that's going on, the fact of the matter is that that war from that started in 1950, you can even backdate it earlier than that, that war has in fact never been concluded with a peace treaty. And in fact, the 1953 Korean War Armistice Agreement actually stated a number of things. It stated that within 3 months' time, that all the relevant parties, and the signatories were China, North Korea, and the United States, had to return to the negotiating table to hammer out a permanent peace agreement, and that within a reasonable amount of time, that all foreign forces should be withdrawn from the peninsula. And this is in the wake of hot fighting that saw an estimated 4 million Koreans killed. This was a U.S. war of intervention, an asymmetrical war in which the United States owned the skies and perpetrated untold bombing ruin from above. The historian Bruce Cummings calls it a bombing holocaust. The United States sought to take out everything in North Korea, including civilian infrastructure like dams, which is a war crime. And as a consequence, the North Korean population was diminished by 30%. And so you're talking about a society that knows so intimately what it means to be in the crosshairs of the U.S. war machine. And it actually, at that time and from that moment forward, has been threatened repeatedly with nuclear annihilation at the hands of the United States.
Well, and why do you think it never was concluded?
Well, I'll tell you why. So let me say, first of all, what happened in the wake of the negotiating of this armistice
right.
agreement was that China immediately withdrew. Within like 5 years' time, China was out of the Korean Peninsula. The United States, by contrast, to this day, stations nearly 30,000 forces on the Korean Peninsula, operates an estimated 100 million 100 military installations, including numerous bases, and has command control over the South Korean army in times of hot fighting. This is all on top of conducting the largest war games with South Korea on an annual basis, and these are war games that simulate the invasion and occupation of North Korea, that also simulate a nuclear first strike, and the decapitation of North Korea's leadership. And so we can't, you know, think about like whether or not the United States would at all tolerate that if Cuba and Russia were to conduct something similar off the coast
of
the United States. And so the reason why throughout the Cold War that Korea was absolutely so essential as a crisis area is that in the wake of World War II, I mean, think about the way that people celebrate the figure of Rosie the Riveter. I don't. I think that Rosie the Riveter is a war icon. She's a total war icon. And so basically, during World War II, the entire U.S. economy was geared toward total war. What that meant was that for the first time, people who were shut out of different, you know, jobs, you know, minorities and women, were all of a sudden permitted to work in factories producing war munitions and the like. In the wake of World War II, you had a U.S. economy that was totally geared toward war manufacturing. It was geared toward war as an economic necessity. And what happened was you could just even see in terms of like what the generals said in terms of Korea. They said there had to be a Korea here or elsewhere in the world. Another general said Korea was a blessing. So in other words, the Korean War rehabilitated a U.S. economy that was increasingly geared toward permanent warfare. And what Korea did was it helped to establish the U.S. national security state, which relies upon covert foreign policy. It helped to establish the military-industrial complex, and it placed us on permanent war footing. Let's flash forward to the present moment. In our current moment, the post-Cold War period, you can see that basically North Korea as a threat has proven to be extremely useful to the U.S. Military-industrial complex. Permanent warfare requires a permanent enemy, and it's no coincidence that when George W. Bush was coming up with his infamous trio of the Axis of Evil, that he chose to keep in there an Asian communist nation that still hadn't come out from the cold, because the United States has ceaselessly sought to isolate North Korea through the most punishing regime of sanctions. And sanctions are not a tool of diplomacy, they're actually a tool of warfare. And what happened, if you even look back to the Barack Obama presidency, every single weapon sales made by the military-industrial complex, so Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, these are the entities that profit from the war industry, not the common people. Every single war exercise with an ally, be it a bilateral war exercise, the way that the United States conducts with South Korea or Australia, or trilateral in some cases, or even multilateral, like the Pac Rim exercises that the United States holds. All of these war exercises, every weapon sales, every sort of deployment of a nuclear aircraft carrier, which is in essence a mobile military base, every single accelerated deployment of weapon systems and anti-missile sort of systems was justified in the name of a dangerous nuclear-armed North Korea. And in point of fact, what Barack Obama's presidency, like what his administration achieved through this, was actually the encirclement of China. And so, you had Hillary Clinton coming out as the Secretary of State. Her first grand tour as Secretary of State was not to the customary destination of American Secretaries of State, which is typically Europe. She went to Asia. And she also wrote a policy piece called America's Pacific Century. And she said to an American population that is sick and tired of war. We have to resist your calls to come home. She said that's because Asia is America's economic future. This is a very old imperialist argument. And she stated that we have to resist those calls to come home, we will, and that we will use a kind of Cold War militarized infrastructure to reestablish, you know, in our sights, that area as the arena of our future. And you can just see, like one last thing, I'm sorry I'm speaking so long, but I'll just say that China is no fool. And so there's no way that China will ever accept the call to be the outsourcer of, you know, America's foreign policy with regard to North Korea, because it realizes that America's North Korea policy is actually an anti-China policy.
Well, this is Linda speaking, and we've been listening to Christine Hong. She is an expert on Korea and the current situation. Christine, I was wondering if you could tell us about the sanctions that have been going on, when they started and how long they've been going and what impact they have on North Korea today, as a sort of backdrop for the current crisis, which does seem particularly heightened, and I'd like you to talk about that as well. But can you say a little bit about the sanctions against North Korea? And who obeys those sanctions?
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Well, the sanctions against North Korea were actually a feature of Truman's war policy toward North Korea. So actually 3 days after the United States, this is declared a police action, you know, and I think that that's a very sort of interesting thing to think about, is at the same time that the United States police violence and police profiling becomes a feature of the post-1945, like, United States, U.S. Society, at that time, the United States is extending its logic of policing around the world, and it launches what it, you know, speciously calls a police action, which is a war. And as part of that, 3 days after, so June 28th, 1950, Truman he applied sanctions against North Korea as very clearly not an alternative to war, but as part of U.S. warfare. And currently, North Korea is the most heavily sanctioned nation on Earth. And these sanctions include things, for example, anything that might be construed as dual use. So if you have, for example, pencil leads, you know, the fact that if there's any, the slightest bit of suggestion that this could be weaponized, this is considered to be absolutely forbidden. And this includes also, like, hospital equipment. And so, you know, North Korea is, and then I should just also say, like, just to bring this up to the current moment, that in the wake of North Korea going nuclear, and its nuclear sort of ambitions have been very clear ever since George W. Bush, under his presidency, the 2002 Pentagon Nuclear Posture Review listed North Korea as a permissible site of a nuclear first strike. And seeing both how a neoconservative, i.e. George W. Bush, as well as a liberal president, Barack Obama, both actually exercised regime change after, you know, for example, George W. Bush in Iraq and Barack Obama vis-a-vis Libya, and that was after Libya actually bargained away its nuclear program, North Korea has seen fit to take the nuclear road because this has been its only way of actually, like, flexing its might, of not only ensuring the fact that its society can survive, but also ensuring that there can be some sort of form of dialogue that takes place, sadly enough. But as you were saying, like, you know, sanctions have been a part of the story all along. And, you know, in the wake of North Korea taking this very committed, like, nuclear path, the sanctions have intensified. And, you know, those go down to, like, any sort of bank that does any kind of business or, you know, is seen to be doing any kind of behind-the-scenes sort of business with North Korea is sanctioned. It's sort of made a pariah within the international community. Any kind of nation that does that furnishes any sort of fuel or energy to North Korea is also sanctioned. But of course, like, really, like, we understand that North Korea's major trading partner is China. So all of this kind of language about sanctions is really, again, aimed at China. And has China complied? I mean, even when China has signed on in certain instances, it typically doesn't, to sanctions against, a UN sanctions regime against North Korea. In point of fact, I mean, even though it's supposed to not be delivering any kind of coal to North Korea, I mean, observers see coal transport going across the North Korea-China border. I'll say another thing, though, which is basically that I'm sure for your audience, they know that sanctions in Iraq contributed to the deaths of, hundreds of thousands of women and children.
Yeah, it's the people that pay with the sanctions.
It's the people that pay. And so there's this kind of fiction that sanctions are a surgical strike against the leadership of a country. But let's really think about what sanctions are, because let's also remember that it's usually people like Samantha Power or people like Hillary Clinton and as well as like neoconservatives. So it's liberal hawks and it's neoconservatives that call for sanctions, and they oftentimes do so in the name of the rights of the human rights of the people. Point of fact, what happens is sanctions are a humanitarian catastrophe, and in the sort of logic of brinksmanship of nations like the United States, what they're hoping to do is to bring the societies in question so to heal that it triggers a kind of internal collapse. So let's be real about sanctions. Sanctions are aimed at creating absolutely unlivable conditions within those societies, and they're aimed at the general population.
And it's exactly what they do. And I want to just take a minute to let you know that you're listening to Positively Revolting with Lynn and Linda Olson Osterlund this morning. And our guest is Associate Professor Christine Hong, who is also on the executive board of the Korea Policy Institute. And we would welcome your calls if you have questions or comments. For Christine this morning, the number is 503-231-8187. You can also contact us at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com and on Facebook at Positively Revolting and Twitter at Positive Revolt. We're everywhere out there. Christine, one thing I wanted to talk about, too, is that this is the nation that we infantilize and mock, and there are entire movies about how silly the Koreans are, and I just find that, of course, not as debilitating to the people of Korea as sanctions, but extremely insulting, and that is no way towards peace, if that's what people want.
Right. I mean, in fact, it's not, you only have to watch movies like Argo and Zero Dark Thirty to understand that Hollywood has long collaborated with the U.S. national security state in terms of churning out propaganda and, jingoistic propaganda. And that's definitely true of North Korea, which has been the butt of no end of Hollywood satire. And, during the Axis of Evil era, the Asia Bureau Chief of Time magazine, Donald McIntyre, he stated that basically even in terms of journalistic coverage, seasoned journalists had to adhere to what he called a demonization script with regard to North Korea, or else they would pay the consequences. And I think, I hesitate to say some of this because of the way that Donald Trump, just crows and crows about fake news. But the fact of the matter is we really have to understand what our primary informational sources are about North Korea. And in point of fact, they're forms of intelligence. And let's keep in mind that intelligence is not neutral information. It's not information for the sake of information. It's not even information that's verifiable. Intelligence is information that is geared toward the operation of war. and the primary sources that we have with regard to North Korea, which every single CIA chief has referred to in these totalizing terms as, you know, an intelligence black hole, or there's always this kind of language about its total opacity and impenetrability to normal sort of intelligence methods. So the two sources are satellite imagery. You know, we can think of Donald Rumsfeld, like using realia, in one of his, press conferences, pointing to a map of the Korean Peninsula at night and pointing out how dark the northern part is and how brightly lit the southern part is. And, his implication, this is when he was actually arguing for the possibility of a sort of two-front war, war in Iraq and war against North Korea. The other sort of form of intelligence is defector intelligence, which people in the intelligence community call human or human intelligence. And, I know that this is an example that Donald Trump likes to bring up, but in point of fact, both of these forms of intelligence were marshaled by Colin Powell in making the case to go to war against Iraq for the supposed possession of WMDs. So we have to understand that when we are being fed information about North Korea, these are modes of intelligence. We also have to understand that all the different experts that are routinely trotted out on CNN and other types of corporate media are actually what you would call North Korea watchers. And North Korea watchers are an extension of the national security state. They're usually affiliated with think tanks, or they're sort of pundits who have absolutely no understanding of what the costs of war are in human terms. And they have no understanding of, I've actually been to North Korea on a peace delegation.
I was hoping you'd bring that up. I wanted to say it was a fact-finding tour. When was that?
I went first in 2008, and I went again a subsequent time. And when you go to North Korea, this is also true for people in the South. I mean, you can scarcely meet a Korean American even, whose family, whose relatives, whose members of their their extended community hasn't personally been impacted in a devastating way by the Korean War. And so, if you don't mind, I actually would love for you to hear, even though, Lindsey Graham is, there's no sort of love lost between him and, Donald Trump, he actually stated something which I think is really worth, just thinking about critically. And so what he stated was, he was asked about, what would happen if the United States exercised a military option against North Korea. And what he stated was something to the effect, this is what he said. He said, yes, it would be terrible, but the war would be over there. It wouldn't be here. It would be bad for the Korean Peninsula. It would be bad for China. It would be bad for Japan. It would be bad for South Korea. It would be the end of North Korea. But what it would not do is hit America. I mean, first of all, this is a chilling example of a certain kind of mindset that is, so inoculated from what war means. And, let's also remember that in terms of U.S. standing forces, that's only 1% of the total population in this country, and it disproportionately draws upon the poor, people of color, and as well as undocumented, people in this country as well. So it doesn't usually affect the likes of Lindsey Graham. But the fact of the matter is when you're talking about nuclear warfare, and we are separated by an ocean from the target, day and age, it's not a Hiroshima, it's not a Nagasaki, that looks like child's play.
Right.
Any kind of nuclear option would be absolutely, let's not be fooled, catastrophic for Portland, Oregon, for Santa Cruz, you know, for, I mean, just, it's a fiction to think, even as horrifying as his statement is about the regional impact, there's no way of quarantining the impact of that kind of nuclear devastation.
That is ignorance and isolationism gone awry in a big way. We've got some callers, Christine, so let's talk to Barth.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for bringing your expertise to us. This is a subject that most people are totally unaware of, and even people who try to keep up on it, as you say, the news, quote-unquote, is pretty opaque. Human intelligence also includes assets on the ground, operatives and collaborators and internal sources. So there is a slightly wider view from that that's available, but everything is filtered through the intelligence arena and the military arena. So it's not anything neutral. The idea that upper echelons of our government and other governments around the world are softening to the idea that nuclear exchanges or impacts are acceptable on any level is really chilling and quite insane. We are having nuclear, not quite fallout, but radiation from the Fukushima plant that's hitting the coast here and in California, you know, for beginners, and as airborne made impacts all over the West Coast primarily, and that's not getting any ink. Your contention that we are infantilizing, as it were, the nation of Korea and especially North Korea is true. They are backward. They are primitive because they have been crushed financially and frightened existentially for decades now. And
I don't know, Christine. Do you think they're backward?
I don't think they're backwards. No.
Okay.
You know, I don't. I think they're. Has North Korea been isolated? Yes. But you know, what's interesting is that you know, the United States doesn't have any kind of. Of course, you know, being at war with North Korea, it has no diplomatic presence in North Korea and has to rely on the Swedish embassy. But, you know, the fact of the matter is in recent years, I mean, like, the UK has an embassy in North Korea, and in fact, you know, the Associated Press actually has an office in North Korea. So it's not as closed to the rest of the world, and as a visitor to North Korea, I can attest to the fact that there is a kind of internationalism in North Korea. It just isn't one that admits the likes of the United States or its allies. And I want to say a couple of things about this. I mean, you know, first of all, like, you have to understand that the kind of I'll say a couple of things. One, you mentioned that intelligence requires assets on the ground. But that is precisely what the United States doesn't have. I mean, the intelligence community has copped to that. You know, the fact that it hasn't been able to penetrate North Korea through the usual means. So what this means is that the source of intelligence, of human intelligence, has been almost entirely defectors, so people who have left North Korea. And you have to understand, like, also in this, with regard to defector intelligence, I mean, let's remember that defector intelligence was at the basis of claims of weapons of mass destruction against Iraq. And with regard to North Korea,
and that was great stuff.
right. And then, like, you know, and here's you know, with regard to North Korea, it doesn't actually take a whole lot to understand that typically, okay, so like, you know, throughout the Axis of Evil period, there were actually liberal presidents in South Korea, but because the United States, which essentially militarily occupies the southern part of the peninsula, because that alliance has been so formidable, what happened was it totally thwarted the attempts of these liberal presidents to establish long-term engagement, meaningful engagement with the North. So that was the hampering condition. But during that time, and then thereafter, there were two conservative presidents in South Korea, one who was just ousted by a mass movement. And so now we're actually at a point where there's a possibility of inter-Korean negotiation, dialogue, and exchange. But during that entire time, when there was first George W. Bush, and then there were conservative presidents in South Korea, you have to understand that, like with regard to North Korean intelligence sources, they would go to South Korea. And South Korea's existence in the first instance was through U.S. backing. The United States, with regard to South Korea, backed a series of right-wing dictatorships. This should not be unfamiliar to those listeners of yours who have done work in Central America and understand things like the School of the Americas and also the way that the United States has routinely, partnered with, fostered, these kinds of right-wing friends. As long as they're our guy, in the parlance of the Cold War State Department, that's all that seemed to matter. And so these intelligence assets which have left North Korea in the South Korean context are then sort of conditioned, and they actually go through a program called Hanawon, where they are conditioned for life in a capitalist system, and they're conditioned also to be stridently anti-communist. In the first instance, that was the only justification of South Korea as a state, was that it was anti-communist. It didn't matter that it was perpetrating radical human rights violations against its own people. And so the intelligence sources are also, I'll say this, like the National Endowment for Democracy cultivates North Korean defectors, and in fact, it'll oftentimes sponsor the writings of these defectors with anti-communist co-authors, and then these defectors are then trotted out on Capitol Hill as testimony against North Korea. So you're not talking about internal sources, you're talking about sources that have been cultivated from the outside, and I want to make that absolutely clear. The other thing, too, is you mentioned Fukushima, and, you know, it's really interesting to understand that with regard to nuclear power, the fact of the matter is that the worst offenders are the United States, France, but also Japan. And so you have like two of the worst perpetrators in terms of nuclear tests in the Pacific, and in fact nuclear aggression in the Pacific, the United States and France, and then you have a victim of U.S. bombing Japan. And with regard to that, that actually also unpeels another sort of fiction that we have, which is that the United States is somehow a responsible proprietor of nuclear power. Point of fact, the United States has the distinction of being the first user. And, within not just like, dropping the bombs on civilian populations in Japan, which was absolutely unnecessary as an act of war. Japan was already on its heels. But not only did the United States do that, but in the immediate post-war period, as the Cold War was dawning, to an ally, the Marshall Islands, the United States conducted from, 1946 to 1958, the equivalent of 1.6 Hiroshima and Nagasaki's per day in terms of nuclear tests, the sort of equivalent effect, and also actually conducted radiation experiments against the Marshallese.
Christine, can I ask you one question about this?
Sure.
Have we got any good polling, any good information about how the South Korean people are responding to the, there's been a rapid escalation of the militarism with the THAAD, the deployment of that system.
Right.
Can you talk about what's the response of the Korean people and what do they want with vis-a-vis North Korea?
You know, ever since there have been polls conducted of the South Korean population in the post-Cold War period, and this coincides with the period of South Korea's democratization, which occurred not because of U.S. intervention, but actually in spite of it. You know, the South Koreans, on the whole, when asked who they are, if they're afraid of the North, say no. And in fact, a recent poll that was conducted indicates that 80% of the population approve of their new president's desire to dispense with the anti-North Korea stance of his two predecessors and to negotiate with North Korea. But that has been consistent throughout the post-Cold War period. And in point of fact, when polled in a comparative way, you see that South Koreans are afraid of the United States setting off hostilities, of U.S. unpredictability and U.S. actions, not that of North Korea. And THAAD...
I'm with them. I mean, this is it's the most... Yes. The United States' view of nuclear, other folks' nuclear power or having any is the most insane projection, I think, and dangerous projection that we have going on right now.
That's absolutely right. I mean, so with regard to THAAD, I mean, I'll say one thing about that, which is basically the United States has deployed in a very undemocratic way. So against the wishes of the residents of the area that is the quote-unquote host to THAAD, the United States deployed that under the previous South Korean president. And in fact, as that president was being ousted, she's the daughter of the dictator. She was draconian in her use of the national security law to, you know, quash any kind of dissent. And she, you know, was embroiled in a huge... you know, scandal involving like the misappropriation of funds. And basically, as she was ousted and sitting in jail, and there was an interim, or not yet sitting in jail, but actually she was ousted and there was an interim president in place, the United States, under the cover of darkness, accelerated the deployment of the different component parts of the THAAD missile defense system. And the rationale for that was that it was supposed to be aimed at containing the North Korean threat, but in point of fact, THAAD was not capable of addressing the types of missiles that North Korea had been testing. And so, what the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi stated was, "Hey, we know what you're doing." And he actually cited two Chinese proverbs, which basically said, you know, like the X figure is doing a clever dance, but we can see through this ruse. And the other one was, you know, you try to act like you're our friend, but we know what's really going on. And so basically, you know, China was telling the United States, look, you're saying that this is against North Korea, but actually the THAAD, you know, anti-missile sort of system penetrates into China. And so China is under no illusions what the United States is doing here.
I don't think anybody's under any illusions except the United States people. Do you?
Right. I mean, and that's actually, it's such an interesting point, you know, because there's a Taiwanese scholar named Kwansing Chen who actually, he came up with this term, like in contrast to decolonization, which actually does have to happen here as well. But in contrast to that, because this is a settler colonial society,
right.
But the fact of the matter is that he uses the term deimperialization. And he says that countries that have been or are empires have to go through deimperialization. But the fact of the matter is that empires extend beyond national borders. The most opaque area of governance for the, in terms of U.S. actions is actually foreign policy, and most people in the United States have no understanding of that. Chalmers Johnson, who is, you know, ex-CIA, but then actually became a kind of anti-imperialist scholar, he said that the CIA coined a term for that, which was blowback, which is, you know, basically the unintended consequences of typically covert foreign policy, which then manifest in the form of what the U.S. population construes as provocative acts of aggression against the United States. And so what are really actually the consequences of very imperialistic foreign policy then appear like as 9/11 spectacle and call out for what appears to be further war intervention and an endless sort of cycle of warfare. And I wanted to make another kind of, and so it makes basically the task of doing any kind of critical educational work or even, you know, any sort of exercise of democracy in this country very, very difficult, because the American people typically don't ever agitate in, I mean, this is never usually the kind of issue in terms of the limitations of electoral politics that ever does prevail.
Absolutely.
You know, and then I'll say one other thing, too, which is that in the time period in which North Korea has taken these steps to become a nuclear power, of course, it's not just the nuclear five, the members of the Security Council, that have tested nuclear weapons. You know, all of them have. All of them have, like, launched ICBMs, too. But it's also the both Pakistan and India have tested missiles, including ICBMs. And yet they are not censured at the Security Council. So North Korea is singled out at the Security Council for sanctions that forbid it from testing the kinds of missiles that other countries are free to do.
I know. And, you know, in the Mideast, there's the fact that Israel has nuclear weapons, but Iran is not supposed to. So I'm going to take just a second, Christine, this morning, and tell folks what's going to come up this morning on KABU at 9 on Pacific Underground, a visit from Jacob Alejandro with Direct Action Alliance to talk about calling out fascism in a time of divided politics. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on Radio Geekly, kicks off a summer with a discussion on comics and how they can be used as tools for social justice. And I want to thank KABU members for your generous support. If you're not a current member, it's easy to rectify that. Just go on to kboo.fm and click on donate, and you can fix that mistake that you have made. So, Christine, we've got Pear is holding on the line, and he'd like to ask you a question. Pear, good morning.
Good morning. You know, recently China and Russia have talked about including North Korea in their Eurasian economic project, and I'm wondering, you think that's a way forward?
You know, I mean, I think yes. I mean, like, you know, first of all, like, you know, it's actually, I do think that there is something very promising about that, and the very fact that North Korea, in this particular moment, I mean, Nikki Haley again has been stating things like, you know, it shouldn't be three against three, you know, and she thinks that China and Russia should somehow sort of align themselves with the United States with regard to, you know, North Korea. But in point of fact, neither China nor Russia typically has ever supported sanctions against North Korea. And also, North Korea is economically integrated into, you know, there is a kind of internationalism that exists amongst those countries. And so, I mean, you know, it's, I guess the question that I would ask is, and this is actually something that the South Korean president has raised as well, he said that he will not be for a kind of hastened reunification of the Korean Peninsula. And what he means by that is that South Korea has no intention of absorbing North Korea along neoliberal lines. And so this is the kind of question that one could pose with regard to Cuba and other places like that, is to what degree are the kind of capitalist possibilities on the horizon so profoundly neoliberal that you can envision there being something, you know, something less than redemptive down the line.
Untoward. You know, I've been listening to so many things about North Korea lately, and I feel bad that I can't remember who this person was talking about extraction of resources that,
right.
Korea just hasn't been able to get those resources going. So we should, that's something we should be able to do.
Well, I mean, I think that it's interesting that during the kind of era of George W. Bush, you know, many of the so-called human rights activists with regard to North Korea who are pushing for regime collapse or regime change, outright regime change, including military, quote-unquote, solutions, they oftentimes would also sort of, you know, hawk the resources of North Korea and point to the fact that post-collapse, you know, here's North Korea, which has some of the greatest concentration of rare earth minerals, you know, in the world. And so, you know, there's all this kind of speculative energy that combined with a kind of supposed human rights attention to North Korea. And it is in no small part because of North Korea's very unique terrain and the fact that, yes, geologically it has a lot of rare earth minerals.
They've been keeping things in the ground.
Christine, how given that the Soviet Union and, or not Soviet Union, Russia and China are appearing to have, you know, have some support for North Korea, I also wondered, when you mentioned Cuba, did Cuba and Venezuela also have positive relations with North Korea?
I mean, Cuba and also, you know, I mean, Cuba, yes, you know, I mean, and, you know, I imagine with Venezuela as well, you know, and Cuba historically, I mean, you know, it's, you know, even just to read the statements of Fidel Castro before he died, you know, with regard to North Korea, there is a kind of clear-sightedness. And so, I mean, even to this day, there still are warm relations. And, you know, also with regard to, for example, Palestine, North Korea has always issued a very sort of clear line on Palestine's right to sovereignty, you know, and so, you know, if you, you just have to think about the immediately prior moment to our current one. So during the Cold War period, there was a strong third worldist consciousness around the world. And in fact, when Kim Il-sung was alive, he was a part of the non-aligned movement. And so there are historic ties in that regard. That also means that North Korea has ties with countries in Africa. Okay, I'm sorry.
No. Thank you for bringing that in as well, because through China and through other countries, I know that I visited China in 76 and it was, quote, just open. And at that time, I had expected there not to be very many visitors, but of course, I ran into hundreds of people from Africa and other nations that didn't consider China closed. It was really, who was closing the door in that case was really the U.S. by not allowing you to have your visa or your passports. But I wanted to ask you if these positive relations with other countries are going to help protect North Korea in the current kind of, it looks like a, you know, like a showdown, a push back and forth between, you know, the comment that this is a 4th of July present with the ICBM missile was both wry and funny, but no doubt inflaming of our military. So can you talk about how these other countries having positive relations with North Korea can help, or do they help support keeping that from getting to the full conflagration point?
So, you know, I mean, basically, the key player here is China. So that in China, you know, and even like, you know, just like the sort of typical even North Korea watchers and the usual sort of spectrum of pundits will concede that China does not want to have a sort of reunified Korea that is friendly to the United States at its immediate doorstep. You know, so there's no interest, China has no interest in seeing that, and you know, just as the United States was touting its ironclad historic friendship with South Korea, the way that the relationship between North Korea and China has historically been described is one of being as close as lips and teeth. And indeed, Mao Zedong actually sent his son to fight in the Korean War. His son was killed in the Korean War as well. And so there are these very, very strong historic ties. And, you know, so this actually, you mentioned the fact that, like, North Korea delivered a 4th of July present, you know, the KCNA, the Korean Central News Agency, actually listed it or described it as such. But the fact of the matter is we're in a kind of era of virtual warfare in which these kinds of shows or displays of nuclear weaponry are meant to, you know, it's kind of like the Clausewitz formula. It's politics, war is politics, you know, by other means. And, you know, we can think back to Donald Trump hosting Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago. And during that visit, that sort of historic visit between the Chinese premier and the U.S. president, Donald Trump stated that over a piece of beautiful chocolate cake, he leaned over to President Xi and said that he had just launched 59 Tomahawk missiles at a Syrian airfield. And his administration also made very clear that that show of force, as well as the mother of all bombs, and that was that struck northern, you know, Afghanistan, that those were both meant as object lessons for North Korea. And since China is no fool and knows that any action against North Korea is actually an action against China, this meant that during a time of supposed hospitality that included, you know, Donald Trump's grandchild, you know, warbling some Chinese song, traditional Chinese song, to the Chinese president and his wife, that there was also considerable hostility throughout that. And there were messages, the messages came across in bombs.
Yeah. Ooh, well, I think we can get one more caller in. Francis?
Hi.
Hi.
The military-industrial complex is alive and well.
Oh, yeah.
I just read a statement recently by Tulsi Gabbard. She's a congresswoman from Hawaii. And that statement that Lindsey Graham made about it's over there, she reflected on the fact that Hawaii and the West Coast are in harm's way and that our government has failed to protect us. But then she went on to discuss the regime change scenarios and how Gaddafi was also had that third world communication with North Korea, by the way. And whenever these countries agree to diplomatically, they agree to stop any kind of nuclear testing or any kind of development of nuclear arms, all of a sudden there's a regime change and the leader is deposed. So for the leader of North Korea to think that if to see this, to see what happened to these other people, why is he going to agree to stop nuclear testing when that appears to mean that he will be deposed? I would also like to say that Tulsi Gabbard is ill right now. I just read that she's been ill for about 2 weeks, and she was too ill to go home for the holiday. So I'm hoping that she's okay, and I hope people will have good thoughts for her.
Who was this again?
And Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii.
Oh, right. Okay, we've got a minute left.
What I would also like to say is all this secret stuff. If you guys ever have a chance to talk about why is everything classified? Why
okay.
is everything
that's,
is classified?
All right, yeah, that's going to have to be another show, care. Francis. Thank you. Christine, any closing remarks? We've got about a minute left.
You know, I mean, I'll just say that, you know, North Korea has been very clear that if the United States stops its war exercises that simulate the invasion and occupation of the North, that actually simulate a nuclear first strike against the North, that simulate the decapitation of North Korea's leadership, if the United States will cease those, North Korea has agreed to cap its nuclear program, not do away with, but cap it. And it has also asked for a permanent peace treaty to end the unending Korean War. The United States has thus far not seen fit to respond. but we have a peaceful alternative at hand. And I think that this is one area where we as a people, we are not served by a president who wants to have a $54 billion war budget.
Absolutely. And I'm going to have to,
services.
Right, okay. I'm going to have to cut it off there. Christine Hong, thank you so much. We will have to revisit this with you, I'm sure, on another occasion. And
and we want to encourage people to look up her article in The Progressive
right.
that was out at the end of April. It's called The Long, Dirty History of U.S. Warmongering Against North Korea by Christine Hong. That's in The Progressive in April. So take a look at that. You'll get a lot of the same information you've heard, but more in depth.
Absolutely. Thank you so much again, Christine. And thank you all for listening. Stay positively revolting, and we'll be back next week.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Dingo, is showing Tuesday, July 18th at 7 p.m. Miles Davis made his only acting appearance in this film about a jazz trumpeter who dares to realize his musical dreams in the Australian outback. The film also has an award-winning Miles Davis soundtrack.
Did you like the music?
Again, that's Dingo, showing Tuesday, July 18th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Gotta go now, John, before they take off and leave me. Nice meeting you.
KBOO Portland.
And coming up on KBOO Portland at 9 o'clock, it's Pacific Underground. That's right. Calling out fascism in a time of divided politics and other topics. At 10, Air Cascadia features headlines, interviews, and commentary with your host, Chris Andre, followed at 10:15 with Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, a Radio Geekly kicks off summer with a discussion on comics and how they can be used as tools for social justice. And thank you to all KBOO members for your generous support. Those who have not yet made that hard left turn into, well, from passive consumption to active membership in the KBOO Foundation can rectify that mistake at kboo.fm, and you click